You know, have you ever driven along a dry dirt road? You're driving along, and what happens? You're kicking up a lot of dust behind you. You're just leaving a trail of dust. And that might be a good way to describe us as we cruise through life, leaving a trail which we generally refer to as a reputation. And it could be dust. Of that value. Or another analogy to use is cruising through life like a boat that is leaving a wake afterwards. And that maybe is a little more positive sense. But we leave a reputation whenever we have a contact with people. And do you really know what your reputation is? Have you ever been surprised when you find out something about your reputation that you didn't know? I've had a few surprises over the years. I'll relate just a couple of them to you. One of them goes back to when I was 16 years old and was in the Boy Scouts. I was a Boy Scout for many years, and even later on was a Scoutmaster when the church scout troop when I was in Atlanta. But along about 16, living in Virginia, we went up into the mountains of Virginia for a week-long summer camp. And while we were there, it was decided that we would. There was an observatory on up higher up into the mountains, and that the troop would go up and visit this observatory. And most of the troop would go up by bus, but some of the senior scouts, about eight or ten of us, were going to hike up to the observatory. Now, we were up in the mountains, but this observatory was up at the top of one of these mountains. And it was all uphill. And we were going to hike up, spend the night, come back. So we had our packs, our sleeping bags, we had our food, we had our cooking utensils. You know, so we were loaded with something to carry. It wasn't just go out and take a little walk kind of thing. And so early in the morning, we headed out, and we timed when we were going to leave, so we'd get there about the same time the bus arrived, that early that afternoon. So we hiked and hiked and hiked and hung down through the morning, and it was kind of tough going uphill. I'd been playing a lot of high school sports, and so I was in pretty good shape. Most of the other guys probably weren't in quite as good a shape as I had been. But everybody was in pretty good shape, and so we were hiking along, and it was having a pretty good time. Along about lunchtime, we're getting close, but let's go ahead and take a break, and we'll eat a sandwich. So we stopped, had a little lunch, continued on, hiking on up through the middle of the afternoon, still no observatory. And after lunch, as we continued hiking, people started getting tired and complaining. And as boys are wont to be, a little cussing, a little profanity about how long this hike is and how hard it is and that sort of thing began to come along. And we continued hiking and hiking and hiking. And pretty soon it was almost dusk. We hadn't found that observatory yet. And so by that time, everybody was complaining. Everybody was in a foul mood. I joined along in some of that profanity and cussing and so forth. We were shot by then. Even the best of us were completely worn out. So we finally stopped. It was getting dark. We said, we're just going to camp here for the night. So we just went off the road, found us an area there in the woods, and didn't even bother to build fires and cook anything. We were so tired. We just ate something, rolled out our sleeping bags, went to sleep. Slept pretty good, as we were exhausted. Woke up the next morning, really hungry, because we hadn't eaten that much that day. So we started our individual fires, and we cooked breakfast. And with apologies to my wife, that is still the best breakfast I've ever had in my life. Maybe it was because I was half-starved, but it had something to do with it. But a couple of boiled eggs and pancakes, and man, was that delicious. And let's show you how tired we were. I rolled up my sleeping bag, and a bunch of wasps flew out of the ground. And it turned out I had rolled out my sleeping bag on top of a nest that was in the ground. And fortunately, I kept them in there all night because I was on top of them. They were not too happy, and I quickly evacuated the area. But anyway, we headed on back down. We said, okay, well, I don't know what happened. We must have taken a wrong turn somewhere. And we had an adult leader with us. And so we headed on back. And it was a lot easier going back downhill. It only took us till about lunchtime to get back down to the scout camp. We never did see the observatory. Well, we got back. And, of course, this is back. There were no cell phones back then. And our scoutmaster had enough confidence in us that he didn't think he needed to send out a search party or anything. So we came back and they said, well, what happened? Where were you? We missed you, and that sort of thing. And I said, everybody's gathering around, wanting to know what happened, what and so forth. And everybody started talking and so forth. And then one guy quieted the crowd, the boys, as he told our scoutmaster, Mr. Sinclair was his name. He said, Mr. Sinclair, I'll tell you how bad this hike was. It even made Avent curse. Now, that was the first I knew that I had that reputation. That was back in a time when I think of a lot of you my age. Remember, you were raised that way. That you didn't curse. And it wasn't that I was particularly religious. As a matter of fact, my mother drugged me to church. I didn't really care much about church and had little interest in those kind of things in those days. But it surprised me because I didn't think about that I had a reputation among my peers. But that became kind of the historic height of the troop, the one that made Avent curse. So we have reputations, and a lot of times we don't realize it. As another case, this was back when I was teaching over at Mississippi State in Starkville. I'd been there a few years, and we had a faculty get-together in the evening, and then we had hors d'oeuvres, and it was a bar set up, and one of my faculty colleagues was acting as bartender. And he came up, got some hors d'oeuvres, and said, I think I'll have a glass of white wine. And he looked at me kind of shocked. He said, you drank alcohol? I heard you were religious. Now, that kind of shocked me. Now, there was one of my colleagues on the faculty that I did some consulting work with, and I had to explain to him that I didn't do work on the Sabbath because he wanted to set up something where we'd do an investigation on the Sabbath, and so he knew a little bit about my religion. My department chairman knew that I went off to a church convention every year, but other than that, I didn't think anybody knew much at all or cared much at all about me. But apparently they did, and small college town. Everybody knows everybody else's business, I guess, and I didn't realize that. But I didn't know I had a reputation that I was religious. But my answer to him at the time was that, since Christ turned water into wine, I figure it's probably okay if you drink a glass of it occasionally. So kind of left it at that. But yeah, we leave impressions on people, and we develop a reputation over time. And I want to ask you today, what is your reputation? What about your reputation? I've been talking, as I mentioned, very, very good sermonette talking about the preparation for the Passover and good advice that was given there. Certainly heed that sermonette. But I've been talking about preparation for the Passover in terms of values. Not just the letter of the law, but living the spirit of the law, the values of the law. I've been talking about that through several sermons. You know, I've talked about things like playing to your strengths, and our main strength is God's Spirit. Without that, we don't really have any strength. Things like cognitive dissonance and how that can throw you for a loop. This last time I talked about being trustworthy and the idea that how much can God trust you? Not just that you trust God, but how much does God trust you? So I've talked about a lot of these things in terms of really looking at yourself. And so today I want to talk about reputation. and ask you the question, what is your reputation with others around you? More importantly, what is your reputation with God? And what kind of reputation are you building? Do you even know what kind of reputation you have? Or might you be surprised, or have you been surprised from time to time, to find out something about your reputation that maybe wasn't quite what you expected or hoped that it would be? Let's begin by talking about, basically what is reputation. You know, what it is. We could say it has a number of elements that we could mention. It's part of it is based on what you stand for, your beliefs, what you can be trusted to do is a part of a reputation. Your track record of accomplishments is a part of the reputation. The esteem that you've earned is also a part of one's reputation. How you've been experienced by others is what a reputation is. It's how other people see you and what they think of you. So you can have a very positive reputation or a very negative reputation. But you need to kind of be aware of what your reputation is, and you need to be building that positive reputation. So as we get almost to the Passover here, it's almost upon us here, just a few more days, and it'll be here, and because we're kind of in the final stages, you might say, of our yearly self-examination of ourselves, and looking at the idea, are we putting sin out of our lives? So how are we doing with building our reputation? God does have something to say about reputations. Let's start by looking over at Proverbs 22 and verse 1. Proverbs 22 and verse 1. A good name is to be chosen rather than great riches, loving favor rather than silver and gold. So here we see a good name. We're talking about reputation. Reputation is more important, according to God, than silver and gold. So God sees this as something that's important. Look over in Ecclesiastes 7 and verse 1. Ecclesiastes 7 and verse 1. A good name is better than precious ointment. A good name is better than precious ointment, is what God says there, inspired to be said through the writings of Solomon. So God says that your reputation is important. Let's turn over to Acts 16 and verse 1. Acts 16 and verse 1. I'm only going to read verse 1s all day today. So. Acts 16 and verse 1. Then he came to Derbe and Lystra, and behold, a certain disciple was there. Of course, this is talking about Paul. A certain disciple was there named Timothy, the son of a certain Jewish woman who believed, but his father was a Greek. And this was in that period of time where there were the Jews and there were the Gentiles. And never the twain shall meet was kind of the mentality up until this period of time when the gospel began to be preached to the Gentiles. But in verse 2, he was well spoken of by the brethren who were at Lystra and Iconium. He was well spoken of. He had a positive reputation. And of course, he was used mightily in the work of Paul later on. But he had a positive reputation, much to the credit of his mother and apparently his grandmother. But we find something interesting going over to 1 Timothy. In 1 Timothy 3 and verse 7, well, this whole chapter 3 is talking about qualifications. First of all, well, what they say here in the New King James is qualifications for bishops. The the literal word for bishop there is overseer. We say elders. You know, we're talking about ministry. And so chapter 3 begins by giving the qualifications for the ministry. And then verse 8, it begins to give qualifications for deacons. But I want to focus in on verse 7 here, which kind of, after running through qualifications for elder, verse 7 kind of sums it up by saying, moreover, he must have a good testimony among those who are outside, lest he fall into reproach and the snare of the devil. And I found that interesting when I thought about that, that the reputation that Paul was talking about here is not just a reputation among us, among this in-group, among the church of God, but also a reputation among those outside. Why? Do we really care what those heathens out there think? Why would we care? Isn't the important thing what we think, what our reputation is among us? Why would we care about those on the outside? What's the big deal there? Yeah, we see all these qualifications that are listed here in these first six verses there, chapter 3, you know, temperate, sober-minded, good behavior, hospitable, not violent, not greedy, all these different things, not covetous. All these different things that are listed here, if we fulfill all that, we really need to worry about our reputation on those on the outside? What about that? You know, but there's a second part of the verse here, verse 7. It says, must have a good testimony among those who are outside, lest he fall into reproach and the snare of the devil. So there's a reason. Have a good reputation on the outside so you won't fall into reproach and the snare of the devil. What's that mean? What's Paul talking about here? There's two things. The snare of the devil. What is meant by the snare of the devil? Well, it could mean one of two things. It could mean the snare that snared the devil. You know, what snared it? And we can find that over in Ezekiel. We might turn over to Ezekiel 28 in verse 12. How the devil was snared. So it could mean talking about that. Ezekiel 28 and verse 12. Son of man, take up a lamentation for the king of Tyre and say to him, thus says the Lord God. So he's representing the king of Tyre, is the one who rules this world. Beginning of chapter 28, it talked about the prince of Tyre, you know, which was the physical ruler, but here he's talking about the king of Tyre, which is Satan, the one who rules this world. And he makes it pretty clear in the rest of these verses. You were the seal of perfection, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty. You were in Eden, the garden of God. Every precious stone was your covering, the sardis, the topaz, and the diamond, beryl, onyx, and jasper, sapphire, turquoise, and emerald with gold. The workmanship of your timbrels and pipes was prepared for you the day you were created. You were the anointed cherub who covers. I established you. You were of the holy mountain of God. You walked back and forth in the midst of the fiery stones. You were perfect in your ways from the day that you were created. Yeah, sounds like a pretty good reputation. Till iniquity was found in you. By the abundance of your trading, you became filled with violence within. You sinned, therefore I cast you as a profane thing out of the mountain of God, and I destroyed you, O covering cherub, from the midst of the fiery stones. Your heart was lifted up because of your beauty. You corrupted your wisdom for the sake of your splendor. Pride. Vanity. Thinking of himself equal to God, as we could turn to other scriptures, which we won't hear. But you see, so that's one thing. that we could be in the same, catch caught in the same snare that Satan himself was, in thinking of our reputation as being so great. But then there's another way, and this is probably more likely what was meant here in this verse 7, back in 1 Timothy 1. He said, lest you fall into reproach in the snare of the devil. Let's look at 2 Timothy 2 and verse 24. 2 Timothy 2 and verse 24. And a servant of the Lord must not quarrel, but be gentle to all, able to teach, patient, in humility, correcting those who are in opposition. So we say that someone who is of a mindset of wanting to teach, wanting to explain, but willing to correct those who are in error, those who are in opposition, if God perhaps will grant them repentance so that they may know the truth, that they may come to their senses and escape the snare of the devil, having been taken captive by him to do his will. So that's probably more likely what Paul was talking about back in 1 Timothy that we just read, that it's very easy to get caught up in the same thing that Satan got caught up in. Deception. And so your reputation inside and out needs to be positive, but at the same time it needs to be real, not some false reputation, else you're liable to be deceived. Now, why would this outside reputation though be so important? What's the big deal about it? Well, as you talked about in my introduction, people are always watching. Aren't you? Aren't you always just kind of alert, watching? Yeah, I think if I started talking about to individuals about reputation of other people, you'd probably have an opinion about everybody sitting in this room. You'd probably have some opinion about their reputation, wouldn't you? Don't you? I mean, yeah, you kind of can't help yourself, can you? It's just there. You get to know people, you get to know them, and they have a certain reputation. We're always watching each other, unless you're asleep. You know, so that's 8 hours a day that nobody's watching you. Well, not quite, because even when you're asleep, if you snore, well, that's part of your reputation, isn't it? So there's no escape from reputation. The only question is, what kind of reputation are you building? Now, I think it's interesting to turn to one of the people who had one of the most positive, strongest reputations in all the Bible, and that's Daniel. And I want to turn over to Daniel 6. You know the story, so we won't read all through it, but I just want to read a couple of verses here. Out of Daniel 6, story of Daniel in the lion's den. Daniel had developed quite he was a captive, taken into the king's court, developed quite a reputation, and the other members of the court hated him because they wanted to be the top dog, and they weren't. King looked to Daniel, and so they concocted this scheme where they convinced the king to declared that everyone had to worship only the king for a month. Knowing Daniel's religion, knowing his reputation. And so the king got fooled by that, Darius. And so he made that a decree, sent it out to the whole kingdom. As you've been following Dr. Levy talking about the Medes and the Persians and the law of the Medes and the Persians, once it's stamped, that's it. You have to live with it. And so if we look in verse 14, he realizes that Daniel's in a trap, that Daniel's been trapped here in chapter 6 of Daniel, verse 14. And the king, when he heard these words, was greatly displeased with himself and set his heart on Daniel to deliver him, and he labored till the going down of the sun to deliver him. But he couldn't find a way out. He kind of boxed himself in, and so said, okay, we'll toss Daniel to the lions, I guess. Now, can't change the law. I said it, can't change it, throw him in. And they did. And of course, God intervened. And you get a real flavor of just how it was back then in terms of the people and the attitudes and the viciousness and the vengefulness of things that took place. You know, in verse 24, once he saw Daniel had been protected, you know, the king gave the command, and they brought those men who had accused Daniel, and they cast them into the den of lions, but not just them, their children, their wives, and the lions overpowered them and broke all their bones to pieces before they even came up to the bottom of the den. You know, that's pretty harsh back then, the way things were. But then in verse 25, then King Darius wrote and sent this out to the empire. Peace be multiplied to you. I make a decree that in every dominion of my kingdom, men must tremble and fear before the God of Daniel. Now think about that. He sent this out to the entire Persian Empire, which is the world ruling empire of that time. You know, fresh from their conquest of the entire, you know, I'd say, civilized world known at that time. But continuing on here, for he is the living God and steadfast forever. His kingdom is the one which shall not be destroyed, and his dominion shall endure to the end. He delivers and rescues. He works signs and wonders in heaven and on earth, who has delivered Daniel from the power of the lions. So Daniel prospered in the reign of Darius and the reign of Cyrus the Persian. Now, quite a reputation there, such that, you know, this was history changing when this was sent out, because it put a label on all the Jews in captivity that their God was to be respected. And this was a time when there was, you know, people didn't understand why we just worship a single God. You know, everybody worshiped a multitude of gods, except the Jews. They worshiped a single God. And it was so different. It set them apart. And said, this is the God that has power. And so it established a reputation among the Jews that their God was the God. Now, so certainly Daniel's reputation, even before but after, was such. Almost astounding. So, you know, you can influence others. You can change the path of history if your reputation with God is like Daniel's. Now, another example of someone with a reputation is Solomon. Go back to 1 Kings 4, and we're going to turn to verse 29 of 1 Kings 4. But Solomon was, he came into the kingship a humble man. You know the story. He comes before God. His father David has died. He comes before God, and he asks for wisdom. God said, hey, I'll give you what you want. He says, just give me wisdom. And so God honored that request in 1 Kings 4 and verse 29. We see that God gave Solomon wisdom and exceeding great understanding and largeness of heart like the sand of the seashore. Thus Solomon's wisdom excelled the wisdom of all the men of the east and all the wisdom of Egypt, for he was wiser than all the men, than Ethan, the Ezrahite, and Heman, the charcoal, and Darda, the sons of Mahol, and his fame was in all the surrounding nations. He had a reputation. being the wisest man in the world was his reputation. But what happened to that reputation? What happened to it? He kind of threw it away, did he not? Got caught up in being too smart, too wise. And he kind of threw it all away, didn't he? But I want you to think about something in terms of the gift that God gave Solomon. Has he not given us an equal or greater gift, each of us individually? Look at 1 Corinthians 12 and verse 7. He's given us His Spirit. And that's one of the things that we have to use. He's given us His Spirit. We've got to use it, take advantage of it, use it wisely. That's our strength, as I said earlier. But in 1 Corinthians 12, verse 7, but the manifestation of the Spirit is given to each one for the profit of all. For to one is given the word of wisdom through the Spirit, to another the word of knowledge through the same Spirit, to another faith by the same Spirit, to another gifts of healing by the same Spirit, to another the working of miracles, to another prophecies, to another discerning of spirits, to another different kinds of tongues, to another interpretation of tongues. But one and the same Spirit works all these things, distributed to each individual as He, God, wills. For as the body is one and has many members, but all the members of that one body being many are one, so also is Christ. So we see here that God has given us a gift similar to what He gave Solomon. And Solomon didn't handle his gift too well. His reputation, you might say, suffered for it. He suffered for it. How are you handling the gifts that God has given you? We talk about reputation, we tend to think of individuals. But groups, societies, have a reputation. Different reputations. As it's described here, we all have these separate gifts, but we're all part of a whole. And so that goes into a part of making our reputation. Each of our individual reputations contributes to the reputation of the whole. Think about it. Let's talk very broad terms. I think everyone here is an American. What's the reputation of Americans? What's your contribution to the reputation of America? Probably not much, huh? Probably a pretty small contribution there. Okay, but all of you, or most of you, I think all of you, are living either in Louisiana or Mississippi. So you're either Louisianans or Mississippians. What about that? How are you contributing to the reputation of Louisianans or Mississippians, depending on where you live? Are you making a contribution to that reputation? Most of you here live in South Louisiana. Are you making a contribution to the reputation of South Louisiana? Do you want to be associated with the reputation of South Louisiana? Might be a better question. But let's narrow it down further. You're members of the Church of God. How are you contributing to the reputation of the Church of God? Is your reputation individually enhancing the reputation of the Church of God? But you're also a member of the New Orleans congregation of the Church of God. So now we're getting a little small, more specific. How does your reputation enhance the reputation of this group sitting right here? You ever thought about it? Now let's get even more specific. Your family. Parents for some, children, extended families. You're a member of a family. how does your reputation contribute to the reputation of your family? You ever give much thought to that? You know, there's individual reputations, and the sum of those reputations give the reputation to the group, us, this church, this congregation, the church of God. How are you contributing to that reputation? Now, some people have done some studies on this sort of thing, and brought out some interesting statistics. And that is that you can measure a group's, or a state, or a nation's reputation. One good way to kind of measure a reputation is to kind of assess the general measure of trust that that group has with other members of the group. Not necessarily, you know, I'm not talking about in a one-to-one relationship, just in general. The general reputation that people have within that group of other people. They might not even know. You know, you think, I'll take Louisiana, for example. What's the reputation of Louisiana? You might say, well, there's good folks. Yeah, there's some good folks in Louisiana. Well, there's some party animals, you know, but we're talking about a general reputation. There's some good things, there's some bad things, you know, there's, you know, and within society, but, you know, overall, just, how do you feel? How much would you trust somebody off the street here in Louisiana, for example? But these are some studies where they tried to evaluate that by measuring the trust, the general trust that people have within different groups, within different states, within different nations. And they came up with some statistics like this. They put it in terms of a percentage. The percent of general trust, which is a measure of the general reputation that people feel within a certain, within their group. Brazil, that level was 3%. Peru, it was 5%. Practically no trust, no reputation in those countries. Norway, the level of trust was 65%, and Sweden was 60%. Pretty heavy, pretty high trust, very different. United States, 36%. But interestingly enough, in 1990, it was 50%. So it's been declining. Great Britain, the United Kingdom, is 44% in this study. And so what they found is it was generally low in countries in South America, in Africa, the former communist countries. It was generally low in those places. It was generally high in the Scandinavian countries, the East Asian countries. And it tended to be better in democracies, tended to be higher in democracies than in totalitarian type of regimes and so forth. But it's a little, you know, when you think about it, the reputation of a group, how that works. What they, you know, what it turns out that law-abiding societies create a reasonable amount of generalized trust. And so here we're back to some laws again. You have laws that are viewed as fair. You know, if the laws are viewed as fair, if the society is of democratic nature, if you know, the more respected the laws, the higher the reputation of society, the more trust there is. Yeah, and if you think about it, I want to use an example of traffic signals. You know, pretty simple, you know, red lights, green lights, that sort of thing, turn signals. You know, they're all over the place, and it's a law. It's a law, you obey the traffic signals. Now, what's the vision of having traffic signal laws? Now, what's the vision? What's the value that is behind it? You know, it has to be some reason why we have traffic signals. What's the vision there? You know, is it not the idea that we need to keep things flowing smoothly, efficiently, safely in transportation? Isn't that basically what the vision is? And so we try to fulfill that vision by having certain laws. And of course, with signals. And of course, sometimes they work pretty good. Sometimes they don't work so good. Especially in Baton Rouge, I've noticed in the last few years. But, you might say in terms of what I've been using as a background to several sermons here, you might say that basically we kind of accept these laws, the traffic signals, that we should obey them. You know, it's kind of like informed acquiescence. You know, okay, we kind of make sense. We need some control. We don't want everybody just careening through the intersections. So, okay, yeah, we'll accept that we have signals and that we should obey them for the general good. You know, so we're kind of in that informed, acquiescent mode. But what happens is some people don't kind of accept that. Like, one of the things I've noticed, for example, is that the right turn signal. Now, you got the right turn signal, that green arrow. It turns yellow, it turns red, people still going. You know, gotta make it. And there's been a little bit of loss of respect for the traffic signal. You know, now, so that's in a negative sense. There's not much respect there. Now, in a value-based mode, then we go further than that, and you see it in things like somebody gets in that turning lane, and they didn't realize it was a turning lane, and they want to get over in your lane, and you have two decisions to make. I'm closing that gap. He was dumb enough to get in that turning lane. He's going to make that turn, and it's his problem. Or, you know, that's informed acquiescence. That's the law. You're there. Obey it. Turn. Or you can ease up, give a gap, let him get in, and go straight on through ahead of you. That's a value-based approach. You know, so we see some value-based approach. We see some informed acquiescence. But what happens if we didn't have... we just said, well, forget about it. We don't need signals. Let's turn them all off. Every man for himself. Would traffic flow better? I don't think so. Matter of fact, if you weren't sure that you could trust the other people to obey those signals in general, even if they were working, if you weren't sure you could trust them, how would you approach an intersection? Pretty carefully. Now, just in general, right now, today, you all probably went through a number of intersections. How did you approach those intersections when you had the green light? How did you approach them? Not about you, but I zipped right on through. You know, maybe glanced a little here and there, but I didn't think about the fact that somebody may decide they don't want to obey that red light in the cross direction. You know, so I have a lot of trust that people are going to stay there until that light turns red and I've got the green and so forth. And, you know, we kind of do that. But suppose people just didn't pay much attention. No, they kind of took a red light as a suggestion that maybe you ought to consider stopping. See, that's what I'm talking about, the level of trust in a society. If you get down to the point where there's no trust, you know, traffic's going to pretty much come to a standstill. There's going to be a lot of accidents. And, you know, basically, you know, you're going to end up being kind of in this realm of anarchy and lawlessness, right? So we see all of these different phases I've talked about of growth just in the way we look at others. Trust, how much we have trust in others. You know, it's that sort of thing. This traffic stuff is kind of crazy. I remember some years ago, I was doing some research for the State Department of Transportation and on repair of bridge girders that were damaged by overheight vehicles that hit them. And we went out to develop a lot of procedures to efficiently repair those steel girders, and we went out to down I-10 to Lake Charles and did a demonstration repair. They had a bridge that had been hit, and it was a bridge over I-10. And we spent a week out there repairing that bridge. I had my team of graduate students and so forth, some undergraduates too. And it was a demonstration project on how the research we developed works. Now, the problem is you've got to block off one lane while you're up there working on the damaged steel. But, of course, I-10, you had to keep one, couldn't just close it down. You had to keep one, at least one lane open. So we had one lane shut down for about a week. And, of course, traffic backed up. I-10 being a busy place. But what struck me as interesting, at this particular point, we're working in the eastbound direction. The westbound, at where we were, had a very, typically a median is about as wide as half of this room or less. Well, the median there was like 40 or 50 yards wide, really wide median, half a football field. So the west lanes were 40, 50 yards away, way over there, and we were working over here. Traffic started backing up over there. Why? They could barely see us from way over there. They were so far away. But traffic backed up. In the course of that week, on that side we were not working on, there were two fender benders. It wasn't a single fender bender on the side we were working on. And I thought that was strange, that there were two accidents because people were rubbernecking, instead of paying attention to what they were doing. And so, these kind of things make an impression, and so societies develop a reputation about a lot of things. How much can you trust a society to obey laws? I think that same thing applies to religious groups, churches, church organizations, congregations, where we're talking about God's laws. Now, a lot of people, a lot of Christian religious groups basically have taken the approach is that you don't really have to obey God's laws. What you have to do is accept Christ. If you accept Christ, then obedience is, you should try, you should be moral, you should behave yourself. But the real main thing is to accept Christ. And what happens when people have that kind of mentality? It's the idea of, if you can't trust people to obey God's laws in a group, it creates a certain amount of uncertainty, doesn't it, in their behavior. And people begin to see a hypocrisy. They see a certain amount of hypocrisy, whether it's the family, whether it's the congregation, whatever. It shows up. The reputation is pulled down because of a lack of trust that you will do the right thing. And your reputation suffers as well as God's. There's a trap that you can fall into. You say, okay, well, let's say in the letter of the law, instead of going further to the spirit of the law, that's what was being talked about in Mr. Cunningham in the sermonette, that spirit of the law, the heart that you have, you have to go further. All the things that Christ talked about in terms of the religious establishment of his time, what basically was he criticizing? The letter of the law, but not the spirit of the law. That's the way he was over and over again. He was telling the Pharisees, the letter of the law, they did well, but they neglected the main thing, the spirit of the law. We need to be building our reputation. We build it through obedience to the law. We build it through value-based living of what the laws represent. And it's important to us as individuals. It's important to us in this small community of this congregation. It's important to us in the larger community of the Church of God. All of it comes together and points to something. We represent God to others inside and outside. We're religious, as I was told that time when I was going to take a glass of wine. Let's look over at Luke 6 and verse 20. Luke 6 gives, you might say, a condensed version of the Beatitudes that were given in Matthew 5. It says it a little bit differently in some expressions. It's certainly condensed from what Christ said. It was quoted back in Matthew 5. But Luke 6 and verse 20. Then he lifted his eyes towards his disciples and said, "Blessed are you poor, for yours is the kingdom of God. Blessed are you who hunger now, for you shall be filled. Blessed are you who weep now, for you shall laugh. Blessed are you who, when men hate you, and when they exclude you, and revile you, and cast you out as evil, for the Son of Man's sake. Rejoice in that day, leap for joy, for indeed your reward is great in heaven. For in like manner their fathers did to the prophets." So we, like I say, condensed version of the Beatitudes. But then in verse 24, some woes. He gives some woes here. But woe to you who are rich, for you have received your consolation. Woe to you who are full, for you shall hunger. Woe to you who laugh now, for you shall mourn and weep. Woe to you when all men speak well of you, for so did their fathers to the false prophets. So here's a warning, a caution about your reputation. Your reputation has to be real. Has to be real. It can't be a false reputation. You know, some people are good at coming across as really good people, but they really aren't. I was listening just to a brief thing on the one of the news channels in Baton Rouge yesterday, and they're talking about some type of con. I forget exactly what the con was. I didn't catch all of it. But the guy that was con was saying, "Boy, it seems so real. If the guys were so nice, you know, all the kind of thing. Just came across as so positive." And he was conned out of a lot of money. And that's the warning here. Watch out if too many people speak well of you. Something's probably not right. You know, like, with apologies to Abraham Lincoln, I'll modify his quote. You can please some of the people all the time, and all the people some of the time, but you can't please all the people all the time. And so you have to be careful about your reputation there, or you might be in that mode of just trying to please people, rather than establishing a real, true reputation. Let's turn over to Romans 16 and verse 17. Romans 16 and verse 17. "Now I urge you, brethren, note those who cause divisions and offenses contrary to the doctrine which you learned, and avoid them. For those who are such do not serve our Lord Jesus Christ, but their own belly, and by smooth words and flattering speech deceive the hearts of the simple." So there are flatterers out there. Are you a flatterer? Are you enhancing your reputation through some flattery rather than sincerity, honesty, and truth? That's easy to do. That's easy to do. But that's a danger. That's a caution. You know, we can be subdued by false reputations. We can fool ourselves by thinking we've got a good reputation, but it's false. It's not real. Look at James 4 and verse 4. Another caution here. James 4 and verse 4. Breaking into a middle of a sentence here where he's talking about people asking amiss in verse 3. In verse 4, adulterers and adulteresses, do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? Whoever therefore wants to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. What's he talking about here? You read it and you think about Christ's instructions, and we'll be reading that in the Passover this week about he wants you to come out of the world, but you're to be a part of the world, but yet come out of the world. And you know, here James is talking about being a friend of the world. What's really being talked about here? Isn't it talking about you've got two sets of standards, the world standards, God's standards? Which standards are you going to follow? You know, you can be fooled into following the world's standards. A lot of pressure out there to follow the world's standards. You know, those standards keep changing, keep evolving. God's standards don't change. They don't evolve. They're always constant. You know, one of the things that's impressed me just in the last few weeks in hearing the news about how effective our internet thrust is, getting up towards a million people, new people, making hits, that the responses, the letters and emails that are coming in are just overworking. Ministers don't have enough people to answer all the letters. Now, Mr. Sanderlands is one of those letter answerers, and he's talking about that. It's just overwhelming. They've had to bring in other help, you know, other ministers who weren't part of that team to help answer some of these things. People are taking notice of what's being preached through our internet presence, and they're beginning to respond. People are beginning to call, wanting to know about things like where a church is, that sort of thing. There will be new people that come in to this congregation. You know, they're going to be influenced. They're going to very quickly see a reputation of this congregation, individually and as a group. What is that reputation? What is our reputation here, this church, New Orleans? I dare say most everybody in this room has attended other Church of God congregations different times. I was just out in Denver skiing a couple of weeks ago, and I was at the Castle Rock Church, which is just south of Denver. And you know, I've visited a lot of churches when I travel and so forth over the years. And I've been in some churches have impressed me differently from others. You know, some churches don't seem quite as warm as others. Some churches don't seem quite as friendly as others. They're different. I've noticed differences among congregations. What about our congregation? What somebody new, just never heard of the Church of God until they got started looking at the internet, made contact, had a visit from the pastor, and they've been invited to come to church. How are they going to be impressed? Positively, negatively, by this congregation's reputation, and by each individual within this congregation and their reputation. One closing scripture here, 1 Corinthians 12. Now, this chapter is related to spiritual gifts, as we were talking about a little earlier, but I want to pick up pretty much where I had left off when I was we were looking at this earlier. For as the body is one and has many members, but all the members of that one body being many are one body, so also is in Christ. For by one Spirit we are all baptized into one body, whether Jews or Greeks, whether slaves or free. All have been made to drink into that one Spirit. For in fact the body is not one member but many. And so it carries through this analogy over the next few verses here. But let's jump down to verse 26. And if one member suffers, all the members suffer with it. If one member is honored, all the members rejoice with it. Now you are the body of Christ and members individually. You're the body of Christ and members individually. Yeah. Individual reputation. The sum of all those parts is the reputation of this congregation. The sum of the reputations of all the congregations is the reputation of the Church of God. That's what people see. That's what people see. Our reputation, individually and as a church, is a good measuring stick that we can use in examining ourselves. What is our reputation? How are we stacking up in our lives? Now, how high is your ceiling? Now, ceiling is often limited. People are limited to a ceiling set by the letter of the law. I've been talking about we need to go, there is no ceiling. Now, the values expressed by the law are infinitely high. There's no ceiling. Where are you? Where are you? There is no ceiling for embracing the spirit of the law. Do you know your reputation, both inside and outside these walls? Are you examining yourself as we come before God, Jesus Christ, and take the Passover? What is your reputation with God?